right, we've ended up with only two cases on our 9 o'clock docket for oral argument. We will hear the first one, and then we will proceed on immediately to the second case. The first case is Wells Fargo versus MBS The Hills. If the clerk will please announce counsel, who will be arguing today?
Please, the court, Mr. John McFarland will argue for the appellant. Mr. Jordan Riley will argue for the appellee, Michael Smith. Mr. Robert Collins will argue for appellee, Edmund White.
Thank you. All right, Mr. McFarland.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I represent Wells Fargo Bank as trustee, acting by and through Oryx Capital Markets as a special servicer for a commercial mortgage trust. There are three points that I want to address, and I want to answer any questions that the panel has. The first broad point is that while this document is styled a non-recourse indemnification agreement, a contract is what it does. And this contract imposes several obligations on the appellees. The several obligations are joined by the word and. So you have this clause that is in section 2 of the non-recourse indemnification agreement. That's in the record at reporter's record 3, exhibit 3. It's the first page. You have that clause. It's the operative clause. And it's the appellant's contention that this court may and must, as a matter of law, construe this clause and apply it to these parties and determine the liability of the appellees. Taking the clause, though, and teasing out the obligations, you find that it is more than a mere indemnity. So even though it calls itself an indemnification agreement, and even though it refers to the appellees as indemnitors, when the contract says that the indemnitor hereby assumes liability for any and all losses, damages, costs, and expenses which may at any time be incurred by the lender, and for which borrower at any time may be personally liable pursuant to the non-recourse exceptions as defined in paragraph 12 of the note, that has to mean something. It doesn't mean merely that they're indemnifying the lender against third-party liability, as the appellees have suggested. At appellant's brief, page 13, I walk through the four of the obligations imposed by that paragraph, taking out the words that aren't necessary to understand that one obligation, then moving to the next. So the indemnitor agrees to pay, and then losses, damages, expenses. The indemnitor agrees to indemnify. No, there's one. Indemnify would be what the appellees say this contract does. But if that's all that it did, then the other verbs don't have meaning. The last point. This agreement provides both the trigger and the measuring stick for the appellee's liability. If the borrower has recourse liability under the notes, paragraph 12, which is what this paragraph, the section 2 of the non-recourse indemnification agreement talks about, if the borrower has that liability, that triggers the appellee's liability under this clause. And it provides the measuring stick for that liability. The trial court found that the borrower had recourse liability. The trial court entered summary judgment to that effect and also entered a finding of fact, which is in the record at clerk's record 563. The trial court found the parties agreed that the note would be non-recourse as to the borrower, except unless certain defined non-recourse exceptions set forth in paragraph 12 of the note were satisfied. That's the hook. And then, number two, the borrower and Normandale are jointly and severally liable under the note by reason of and through the non-recourse liability exceptions of paragraph 12 of the note. That finding of fact tracks the liability hook in the non-recourse indemnification agreement, section 2. And so it is the appellant's position that this court may and must look at these two contracts, interpret this clause, construe it, and in doing so, we believe the court will conclude that the liability of the borrower is the trigger and measuring stick for the liability of these appellees, and therefore the court should reverse the trial court's judgment and render judgment that the borrower's liability is coextensive, jointly and severally liable for these appellees.
And is that true for all of the indemnitors?
It is.
Because didn't the trial court leave out one or two of them?
No, there were only two indemnitors under the agreement.
Okay.
Mr. Smuck and Mr. White.
Which at any time, then the words appear, may be imposed upon, and is a judgment for damages against a maker of the note, something that's imposed upon the lender.
What the agreement actually says, it says, does say imposed upon. There's, I think, three ways of describing it, and I believe that in looking at them, you would say that they tried to cover the waterfront. It is, which at any time may be imposed upon, incurred by, or awarded against. I think they were trying to triangulate every possibility for how that loss may be.
And if it was meant to be a guarantee, then that word could have been used, couldn't it?
It certainly could have. It honestly, in reading this agreement, you almost feel like some lawyers got together and had a bet that they could draft an enforceable guarantee without using the word. But a contract is what a contract does. Well, and that's this court's task, to see whether they did, I suppose. In reading it, in trying to give these words meaning, it seems to me that if you are assuming liability for and agreeing to pay and agreeing to indemnify and agreeing to hold harmless the lender, that is a very broad financial undertaking. And the measuring...
The trial court interpreted these words to mean, as I understand, look at the documents and look at the records, that those words indicated an indemnity. I know that's directly in the counter to your argument, but how do you approach and how would you discuss the cases that say that whenever we're looking at language in a document, deciding if it's a guarantee or an indemnity, that you, when you don't use the words guarantee, that you are leaning towards the interpretation that it is an indemnity on third-party claims as opposed to direct damages from the actions of the note holder?
Right. Well, the first thing I would say is that this court reviews the trial court's finding as to the construction of the contract under a de novo basis.
And I understand that.
I know I'm not right. So you have the title of the agreement and the words used, but the impact of the sentence, the impact of the operative clause, is to impose a broad financial obligation and undertaking. So even though they didn't use the word guarantee, you still have the obligation to pay, to protect, to hold harmless, and indemnify the lender. It can't just be that because we called it an indemnification agreement that the other verbs in the operative clause don't have effect. If you look at the next paragraph, paragraph 3, and this doesn't show up in the brief, but in reading paragraph 3, what you see are the terms of a guarantee not merely of collection but of payment. Now, they don't use the word guarantee, but these clauses are the types of clauses you find in guarantees. So the title of the document is one thing, but if you entitle a document deed and you merely grant to the grantee the right to possess the property for a term, it's not a deed, it's a lease. So this is what it does and not what its title is, and that's sort of the real fundamental point, I think.
How do you respond to the fact, though, that opening paragraph 2, where it talks about indemnification, specifically refers to paragraph 12?
Yes, the note and the indemnification agreement walk together, and that actually is another way you can understand that this is, in fact, intended to be a guarantee rather than an indemnification agreement. In the Thomas Inc. versus Graham case, which is referenced in I think both Mr. Smuck's brief and my brief, The notion that a indemnification agreement is a standalone obligation, whereas a guarantee is a collateral obligation. This agreement is clearly collateral to the note. So the trigger for the indemnitors is the borrower's liability under the note. This was a non-recourse transaction unless the non-recourse exceptions were met under the note. And that's what the summary judgment was about. That's what finding of fact, the additional findings of fact show, that there was, in fact, recourse liability by and through reason of the non-recourse exceptions under the note. So that's the when I say the trigger and the measuring stick, that's referencing back to the note.
Last thing, Mr. McFarland, can you single out the portion of the record that specifically addresses the proof that was presented of waste on the part of the borrower?
The waste on the part of the borrower was established by summary judgment and is wrapped into the summary judgment. The summary judgment briefing, I believe, is in the record, but it is our position that we would not have to prove waste twice, and I'll demonstrate. If we had proved, let's say we bifurcated and proved, taken the case against the borrower to trial and then waited for the case against the guarantors, and put on a waste case against the borrower and proved $5 worth of damage of waste, and then took the case to trial against the guarantors, the appellees, and proved $100,000 worth of waste, they would argue, of course, that no, our measuring stick and our trigger is the borrower's liability, and it can't be more. And I think the same is true in the reverse. The borrower's liability is the measuring stick. If the borrower is liable, then the appellees are liable under their non-recourse indemnification agreement, and they're liable for the amounts that the borrower's liability.
What is your position as to whether, if there was waste, that the measure of damages would be the amount in value or the dollar loss by as a consequence of waste, as opposed to full liability on the note?
That's accurate. I mean, I think that's an accurate statement of the law. And so what you have here is maybe a procedural wrinkle, but the fabric of the law must be protected. The borrower is liable for the full recourse under waste. It may be that a different trial would have resulted in a different result. But here, on summary judgment, the trial court concluded that this borrower had liability for what ended up being full recourse under the exception, the non-recourse exception of waste. And so, full stop, we don't look past it. There's a summary judgment, and that's not been appealed. It's not been challenged. And so that is why the case was tried the way it was tried. And there is a witness. We had the receiver, Bruce Woodward, who went to the property. He was the sort of catalyst for why this lender looked at the property differently and said, well, what happened here? This isn't merely turning the keys over and saying, sorry, my business deal didn't work out. This is, the property is a mess, and there's doors off of units that can't be rented. You're taking doors off of units to put them on other units, and then therefore just you have a mess.
Thank you, sir.
Am I remembering correctly that at least one of the appellees, I believe, White, deemed
admissions as to waste? Yes. White had deemed admissions as to waste. And those were offered in the trial. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. McFarland. Mr. Riley.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent Michael B. Smuck, who is a defendant at trial, a defendant business individual, and he was pursued at trial. I have really one point. He was pursued at trial as an effective guarantor under this theory of the way that the indemnification agreement operates. And it was our argument at trial, and the trial court agreed with us, that the indemnification agreement cannot operate as a guarantee, given the relationship of the parties to the agreement and the terms of the operative clause. The basic point is that it was Wells Fargo's predecessor in interest, the appellant, that was offered protection. And it is the language of an indemnity contract. It is protection that is being offered through the words impose, incurred by, and so forth. And because it's Wells Fargo that's being offered protection, and because an indemnity contract, it is this contract for protection, because that necessarily involves claims brought by third parties, that is an indemnification contract. Now, the language does get confusing because then they identify what the potential liability is, and they refer to identify that, they refer to this potential liability that a third party might have to the promisee, the indemnity here. And that can be confusing, but it's still very clearly an indemnity contract with a definition of what the potential liability that is protection against is being offered. If it were to work as a guarantee of Hills's liability, it would have had to have been that my client was offering Hills protection. And in that kind of a contractual relationship, and I think that Graham speaks very clearly on this point because it was the same situation in Graham, if you're saying I will protect that third party for their liability to you, that's a guarantee, and Graham found. Whereas a direct indemnification agreement is I will protect you. That's an indemnification agreement. And as for the identity, if we want to look at, you know, what is the practical function of the contract, I believe it would be that if these are special purpose business entities and they were formed to get the financing, purchase the property, hold it, manage it, and it's foreseeable that you might have a situation where some third party comes at the business entities and the lender and maybe even the individuals for some liability for fraud that the lender maybe should have known about or so forth and so on. And what this contract is doing is it's transferring that risk. It's saying that as the lender, if a third party comes to us for satisfaction for something coming out of these non-recourse exceptions, we're going to look to you. But there has to be that third party coming because that's what the agreement is to protect against that. And there was no third party claim shown at trial. Rather, there was simply a judgment in their favor. For that reason, the trial court, we believe, correctly found in our favor. No, ma'am, I don't believe so because I believe the other justice mentioned this. It mentions that, but there's another clause there which may be imposed upon, incurred by, it's identifying the broad ways in which they're offering protection, and then to identify the protection, it's saying that to denote that it's protection. It says that which may be imposed by liabilities, which may be imposed by, incurred upon. Or imposed on the promisee, here the appellant. It was our position at trial that it does, and that was my argument at trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Riley. Mr. Kulig.
Thank you. May I please the court. My name is Rob Kulig. I'm here with Mr. White. Mr. White signed one document. He signed an indemnification document. You'll see these masses of notes and the like, but White is here because he signed one document, an indemnification document. Counsel for Wells Fargo, nowhere in their brief, addresses the fact that indemnification agreements, by their very nature, are to be strictly construed. And I found it, if the situation wasn't sort of dramatic, almost amusing that they might have had a little internal gamble as to whether or not they could persuade a borrower to sign a document that says on its face it's an indemnification that is to be read literally and strictly as a guarantee. And then they go one step beyond that. They proceed to trial not against White, not against Smuck, but against only the holder that they know is unrepresented, or only the note maker that's unrepresented. And Justice Meyer, you asked a pertinent question. What about waste? What about damages? There is not a scintilla of evidence in this record about waste. They are self-conclusionary statements. Waste, as you know, is a legal term. But in the affidavit and in the testimony, the affidavit and in the report of Mr. Woodward, he doesn't use the term waste. He doesn't try and segregate out those things that might necessarily happen either as deferred maintenance or because they're not making the payments on the note. They come in after the fact and say, oh, all of this must be waste. Indemnification doesn't work that way. If, in fact, I am to indemnify you, it is particular and peculiar to the circumstances as we agree. It's particularly true when the person or entity seeking indemnification has drafted the obligation, has presented the potential borrower and the indemnitor with those documents as a fait accompli, signed this. You can't then take that and say, oh, but wait, what we really meant to say was you're a guarantor. And what we really meant to say is we don't have to put on evidence particular to the waste. How would one give a judgment in this case if we assumed that the trial court was wrong, and she was not, but if we assumed it, for how much? Was there a dollar's worth of waste? Or as they would have you suggest that everything was a result of the waste? Well, but
so are you now saying you're trying to appeal on that issue, or
no, ma'am.
To raise that issue at this point?
No, Justice Gabriel. What I'm trying to do is demonstrate to the court, and you and I may have a slight difference of opinion. It only says it's a judgment. It doesn't say it's a judgment on waste. It doesn't say that there has been a particularized finding. It says that there is a judgment. It does refer to the non-recourse provision, but again, it's not a guarantee. There need to be some particularized finding against Mr. White. In the record, as they know, Mr. White says, hey, I just came in and signed the document. I believed it said what it said, and I didn't even interpret it to mean that. But I'm not going to try and contest with you what the record demonstrates, and we didn't appeal that judgment. We didn't have standing to appeal that judgment. We don't represent the entity. That's part of the issue here. We represent Mr. White. And Mr. White has a particular issue, which is he indemnified for certain limited things. And there is not a basis in the record on his case, on his trial. There's simply a summary judgment against a third party. That doesn't lead to a finding that leads to waste that makes him an indemnitor on that. And it certainly doesn't give us any definition as to how much, if at all, he would be responsible for. I wanted to get into, Justice Livingston, you, I believe, asked the integration of clauses 2 and 12. I think that's another example. White doesn't sign the agreement that has 2 in it. He only comes in on 12. And it refers specifically to, you know, those limited circumstances. And all of this begs the issue, if it's so clear, why is the bank contorting itself to say it's a guarantee? It's because the obligation isn't that clear. The record isn't clear as to what Mr. White would owe, if anything. There is no finding of fact on which they can base it against White. They tried to do this, I don't want to say on the cheap, but easy. They could have come in and presented their evidence. If there was evidence, come in and prove it against White, against the company at the same time. Show them what you have. Let Smuck cross-examine and say, what do you mean this way, sir? How much of this is in apartment 102? And he's none of that. They're a conclusionary statement. They didn't get a motion for summary judgment against White.
No, but that's where they would have had to prove the waste, isn't it?
But there is no specific finding even there, I think the court would agree with me, as to what was the amount that they found in waste. Okay.
But they weren't required to come in a trial against your client and prove how much the waste, the damages for waste.
Well, it depends. And I don't want to give up on what I think is a valid argument, but let me assume that you're correct for a moment. In this case, on this record, there's nothing to say what the waste was. So in order for what I'm going to perceive your question would lead to, for them to be able to proceed on that sort of argument, they would have had to find, hey, we put on evidence of waste. There'd have to be something in the record that says waste. There'd have to be a finding of waste by the court. And there wasn't. And then certainly there'd have to be some amount.
I'd ask you this, sir.
Yes, sir.
I know that MBS of the Hills Limited and 3101 West Normandale, not your clients.
Yes, sir.
However, was the judgment on interlocutory summary judgment based upon a claim of waste, or was it based upon a claim of the breach of the loan documents themselves in terms of non-payment and other matters?
It's hard to say from the record, and I want to be candid with the court. Certainly, they put on an affidavit that talked about the condition of the property. I think that the judgment can be read that it includes perhaps failure to maintain, certainly a failure to pay. The reason they took over the property wasn't because they came in and said there's waste on the property. They came in and took the property because they weren't making the payments. And so as I read the judgment, it looked to me like a deficiency judgment. We see these every day. You don't pay the bills, we come in. They don't come in and say you did it because of waste, because it's easier. They come in and say you haven't paid your bill. Sure they were. They could come in and get a judgment against, I'm sorry, you're right. I apologize. You're absolutely correct. They had to have a finding, but they also were entitled to get a judgment because they weren't being paid against the property. And the property was what was held by the entity. Right. We're in agreement. Thank you all very much for allowing me to participate.
Thank you, Mr. Kuig. Mr. McFarland.
Thank you. This was a special purpose entity transaction. The idea that you would have one of these commercial mortgages set up to give title to a entity that doesn't have any other assets or any other business, typical special purpose entity. These non-recourse transactions are set up, I call it lemon socialism, where if they go and knock it out of the park, they make a bunch of money, the bank just gets its interest. If market conditions or any business reason, legitimate business reason, causes the property to decline in value, they can turn over the keys and say, we tried, and the loss falls on the lender. It, as Justice Gabriel and Justice Meyer pointed out, it is only if there was a non-recourse exception that the lender gets to look to the borrower for recourse. But we know that the borrower is a special purpose entity, doesn't have anything except for this piece of property. For it to have meaning, you have the agreements of the principles behind it to back up the recourse liability. That's why the trigger and the measuring stick for these parties, these appellees' liability, is the liability of the borrower, the recourse liability of the borrower. Mr. Kuig has left out of his analysis the findings of fact that the trial court entered at Clerk's Record 563. I don't want to read them again. I read them in my original. So there are findings of fact that make it crystal clear how the borrower could be liable and why the borrower here was liable. If there are no questions, I'll cede my time. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. Your case is submitted.